Hey everyone, it's Tia from the I Read Comic Books podcast, the best comic books podcast out there. Now, I know what you're thinking. Tia, you're pretty biased. There's like a lot of good comic books podcasts out there. But IRCB is a special one. We don't just talk about what happened this week on the latest issue of X-Men. I mean, okay, we do talk about that like a lot, because Mike is on the show, but we also talk about other stuff. We talk about indies, we talk about Image, Valiant, DC, we talk about manga. Mike has assembled a team of truly fantastic human beings with a huge range of interests and ideas. And honestly, one of my favorite things about this show is getting all the recommendations of things I would probably never have picked up on my own and just hearing new perspectives from these people. They're great people. We also talk about broader topics in comics, from how to store your collection, what makes a good horror comic, why it's important to recognize letterers and colorists and editors. We talk about the male gaze and big screen adaptations, going to conventions, and pretty much everything under the sun that has to do with comics. IRCB is a great show because we really care about comics and we really care about the comics community. We want to be a positive part of building the comics community, so we strive to contribute something to it with each episode. It feels like just about every week we fix comics, and every week our solution is basically be good to each other. Mike isn't exaggerating when he says on every episode that the IRCB crew are some fantastic human beings. After 2 years of being on the show, I now consider them some of my dearest friends. I hope that people who listen to this show feel like they're just hanging out with their friends talking comics. Help us make an even more awesome fourth year by backing us on Kickstarter, where we're raising funds to upgrade our equipment and level up our content. You can find the show at IRCBpodcast.com, and don't forget to check out our Kickstarter. We have some pretty great rewards like stickers, t-shirts. You could even commission an episode. How cool is that? Thanks for listening.
This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. With me this week are two amazing, fantastic people, Tia Vasiliou.
Hello.
And Nick White.
Hey.
So glad you're both here with me this week. Super excited that our Kickstarter is almost funded. It's the craziest thing in the entire world. If you haven't heard of the Kickstarter, head over to IRCBpodcast.com/KS2017. Go back that, get a t-shirt, get a sticker, craft a show. You could be on an episode of the show, but enough about that. I'm here to ask you the question, Nick and Tia, I'm here to ask you the question that I ask every single week. How have you been? How have comic books been? Let's start with Tia.
Well, I feel like I've just kind of been in a haze of comics for the last 2 weeks because last weekend was Comic-Con and I didn't take any days off after. So I've basically just been like comics up to my eyeballs for a long time now, forever,
right,
since the
right.
beginning of time, basically.
Plus, you're the coolest person ever, and all you did was just hang out with comic book creators for a week, right?
Well, I mean, it's partly my job to like talk to them and stuff. So, you know, it's not like I'm just cool. They hang out with me. They kind of have like they're like obligated to give interviews, I guess.
Oh, I see. I see.
But it was a lot of fun, and hung out with some cool people, including you.
Oh, yeah, I was also there.
You were there. Anyway, I did read some comics also.
Ooh,
yeah.
What'd you read?
Well, I was super excited that my copy of Femme Magnifique came, which I backed on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Did you get one?
I did, too. I got one of those as well.
Oh, it's so good. It's so beautiful. Elsa Chartier did the like little cool logo for it, and this really nice hardcover anthology of I think 50 little comic stories about like inspiring women throughout history and pop culture and politics and just the world. And there were some really neat creator team ups in there and some really fantastic stories about, you know, women who've inspired me, women who, this was my first time hearing about them. And it was just really, if, you know, this book is about women inspiring people, and it definitely achieved its goal. And then my favorite part is that in the back, there's a couple of pages that are just like blank panels, and you're supposed to make your own comic about someone who inspires you. Oh, I can't wait to do that.
So awesome.
I don't know who I'm going to do it about. I have to think about it. But yeah, no, it was neat. Like, there was a Misty Copeland story. There was an Artemisia Gentileschi story. I think my favorite was Peggy Guggenheim, because I want to be Peggy Guggenheim. So, you know, yeah, I'll never be Peggy Guggenheim. She was.
But you know what? That's a very good goal to have, though.
Can I be Peggy Guggenheim without wishing that my dad would die on the Titanic so I would inherit all of his money?
Yes. I'm going to say yes.
Dad, if you're listening.
Barring time machine scenarios, I think you're going to be okay.
Dad, don't go on any cruises. Okay.
don't sit on the deck of the ship with the band and let it go under, you know?
Right,
don't
right.
Don't do that, yeah.
So for those who didn't get in on the Kickstarter, what are the alternative ways to get your hands on this book?
You can buy it on Comixology.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Other than that, I don't know.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know if they're doing any more print versions, or I feel
this
like maybe
like
they're going to release.
People would want in print.
It is pretty beautiful.
Yeah,
It's a fantastically, it's a beautiful hardcover. I feel like they're going to release a soft cover, but I could be wrong about that. But Comixology, you can definitely get it on there.
Yes. What else? I read Runaways #2. I know Mike, you read that too. So if you want, we can hold off and talk about that later.
No, go for it. I've got a whole rant about another book that I want to go
okay.
into. So
oh, cool.
No. Yeah.
Because when #1 came out, we were all saying, if you don't know who the Runaways are, this book is not for you. I feel like after reading #2, I kind of want to amend that. I think that the second issue did a little bit of backstory because, you know, so they bring Gert back from dead and she's like, great, where is everybody? Because what they basically did was they rescued her from 2 years ago, the moment before she died, and brought her to the present and then fixed her. And so to her, 2 years ago was just now, but to everyone else, it's been 2 years and everyone's gone their separate ways. And so they're kind of explaining to her what happened to everyone in the interim.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I thought okay, cool. So if you don't know who any of these people are, you read the first episode and you're like, oh my God, this is so exciting. I don't know who you are, but I'm with you. And then the second issue, it's like, oh, that's what happened. That's your deal. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was
actually kind of relieving. I mean, I was worried that they were going to keep down that path, but getting that catch up felt really nice about that book. That's all I'll say about it. But yeah,
it was good. It was really well integrated. I think it didn't feel like, and now sit down, children, for exposition time. It was,
yeah.
You know,
let's
like,
catch all of you up.
So, and this is Rainbow Rowell and Chris Anka and Matt Wilson.
Yeah,
that's
and
a bit of
brilliant.
A relief for a book that's clearly, I think, trying to be accessible to a younger audience. I think that's pretty important that they actually got around to bridging that gap.
Yeah. I mean, I still would say you definitely want to read the original Runaways because it's awesome.
Right.
But, you know, I feel a little more confident recommending the new Runaways to new readers than I did after having only read the first issue. I think that, yeah it's going to be fine.
Okay.
What else? Aphra #13, which is the end of the sort of year one. And moving forward, I think Cy Spurrier is co-writing with Kieran. So things are going to be different. I don't know how they're going to be different, but they definitely will be. Hmm. And, you know, so she manages to extricate herself from the terrible situation that she found herself in. She returns a bunch of artifacts to this university, and I was really hoping they would confer an honorary doctorate on her for that. it was right there. Why didn't that happen?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen. And so then she's like, I'm going on vacation. And then, of course, trouble finds her because she's Aphra. And apparently,
just changed the book to Honorary Dr. Aphra. It's just a new miniseries.
That would be awesome. Darth Vader and Rur, the Jedi in the crystal, don't kiss, which was very disappointing. But I did feel like, you know, I don't know. There were some, I know people ship Aphra and Darth Vader, and I don't think that's appropriate in any way. But in this issue, I was like, okay, I guess I could see where you would get that. Yeah, I'm really excited that Aphra's so popular. They're going to continue having her series because we need more badass ladies. And, you know, like, Leia's technically a good guy, but she's like a complicated good guy. But it's nice having just a like badass chick in Star Wars.
Yeah, totally.
And then, of course, I read The Wicked and the Divine 32. Things happened. I'm devastated.
Oh, my heart. Oh, my God. That fucking issue.
Right?
Yeah, that's all I'll say about it. That fucking issue.
I know. I don't even know what to say. It's just, yeah. And it's not even the end of the arc yet.
I know.
Those are my favorite moments when they don't even end it, like end the arc with it. They just like throw it right in the middle and it's like, deal with it.
Oh my, it's so frustratingly good.
Yeah, and beautiful. Like, so the party rave issue from issue 8, the Dionysus issue, and then they do that again like somewhere in the 20s where they have like all the cool color backgrounds and like framing the panels and the color story of the gutter colors, like it is part of like a really integral part of the storytelling and what's going on and like who's winning and who's doing what. And so they bring that back for a few pages in this issue, and I just love them. They're just so good at making comics. And that's all I'll say. I'll move on.
I agree. Yeah. That's all right.
Sorry. Oh, and by the way, I just assume everyone knows who I'm talking about. This is Karen Gillan, Jamie McKelvey, and Matt Wilson, who are all genius. And and I should also throw out, oh God, Clayton Kells, who does the lettering. And the lettering in Wicdiv is like super important because of the gods and their powers and things like that.
Right.
So Clayton Kells also letters Redlands, Redlands was out too, number 3. It was like super messed up. If you are a man and you want to be really uncomfortable, you should read Redlands.
Oh, I'm so excited to read that later today.
Spoiler alert, the dog does not die. And I just feel like that's important to say for some people.
Right? Good to know.
However, the dog does some fucked up shit. Like, the most fucked up shit.
Okay, no spoilers. No spoilers. I haven't read it.
And that's Jordy Belair and Vanessa Del Rey and Clayton Coles. Anyway, my Clayton Coles story really fast is that I was like, how many books does this guy letter? Because does he ever sleep? And so I Googled him, and the Google results are for Jamie McKelvey. Like, there's a picture of Jamie that comes up in his like little bio. Right? Isn't that awful?
Google gone wrong.
That's like someone needs to call them and be like, "Excuse you, do you know who Clayton Coles is? Cowles.
1-800
Google.
I thought it was Coles.
Cowles.
Oh no, I didn't think
Clayton,
we were gonna have this
debate.
Sorry,
we're the worst people in the world.
Tia said it with such confidence. I was like, she must know what she's doing.
I was confused. I thought you corrected yourself, Tia, because you said Cowles and then you corrected
I've never met him. And so now I'm like, wait.
And now we'll never get
Is Clayton even real? Like, maybe Google knows something we don't.
Oh God.
Oh,
yeah.
I never considered that.
Yeah. Clayton, if you're real, I'm sorry. Tell me how to say your name. You're great.
I'm going to pull up that tweet after when we go to the break. Anyways, Nick, what did you read this week? How have you been? All that jazz.
Been pretty good. Not that bad. Currently doing a little house sitting and looking after a cat. So sort of just tentatively looking over and hoping the cat doesn't wake up anytime soon and mess with my very, very compact audio setup. But that being said, things are good. I've read some books. I read Rebels number 6 again. Yes, I know this issue is a little old. I fell behind. This is, of course, is Brian Wood and Andrea Moody, who has drawn a fair share of Rebels, both miniseries. Oh, sorry, I should correct. This is technically Rebels, These Free and Independent States number 6, I guess. This is the second run. So the main part of this run The big arc that ran for the first five issues of this maxi series is wrapped, and so, like what Brian Wood likes to do with a lot of his runs, he does a longer arc and then wraps it with two or three one-shots that tell different stories and frequently bring in rotational artists. I think I've discussed this before. This one is actually about George Washington and how he more or less had a significant contribution to kicking off the French and Indian War by making some decisions that were not really well-founded in anything other than bravado, it would appear. So it's an interesting different side of him, and I really like issues like this because you have to sort of figure out, I mean, you don't have to, I enjoy going on Google because I hate myself, and sort of reading up a bunch of things, falling down the rabbit hole and trying to figure out where Brian Wood was, you know, narratively embellishing and where, you know, the core kernels and facts sort of lie. So that sort of stuff is fun. I think that's what I really like about this series. It's so tough to get books that are sort of educational and informative that, you know, aren't like, now sit down and here's five paragraphs of text and here are your keywords. Right. So really enjoying this. I still feel like it's one of those really great books that no one is really talking about at all. It would have been nice to have Tula Lote covers again for this run, but I realize Brian Wood probably already has her busy working on other books all the time. So you get what you can get. I read Ninjak Zero. This was the last issue written by Matt Kint, and was sort of a passing of the torch. Matt Kint tells a story at the beginning, along with the help of Francis Portella, and then a rotational team of artists. I'll get into that in a second, because I know normally rotational team of artists is a four-letter word, but in this book it's actually really well done. But the other part is that it's bookended. I shouldn't say bookended. It's at the end you have Christos Gage, the new writer, who is probably best known recently for doing a lot of work on the Netflix series Daredevil, with Tomas Giorello, who's sort of Valiant's upstart, you know, super hot artist right now. You know, they had him kick off the run on EXO, and they had him close out Bloodshot Reborn. So. But it was a really, really cool issue. I know, I think Tia even talked about this recently. I think on, was it Facebook Live? I can't remember where, because you were discussing the cover, I believe, the David Mack skulls and whatnot.
Oh, yeah. It must have been on Comixologist Live.
I think that's what it was, yeah.
It was very cool, in any case.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm here to say that beyond the cover, it's actually really cool, too, in an idea that was attributed to Matt Kint's wife, Charlene Kint. The issue begins with this big splash page of Ninjak launching an arrow, and then for the rest of that issue, you see the arrow slowly moving through the middle of all of the pages, just bisecting all of the pages, and on the top half, you have a largely silent story drawn by Portella, which is Ninjak just sort of going about his ways on a normal mission, showing all of his abilities and attributes and just overall deadliness in all ways, shapes, and forms. And then on the bottom, you sort of have this tale of Ninjak growing up and all of the different phases of his life, just sort of being abandoned and left alone as a kid, and going to, I think there's like sort of the stage where he gets recruited by MI6, and for each era of his life, they bring in a different artist, some of which had worked on Matt Kint's Ninjak run, and each artist tells that different era of his life. And then at
that's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, and then at the end of the issue, everything comes back as the arrow actually becomes a core part of the plot towards the end. Really neat. There must have been a lot of editorial heavy lifting to make all of this happen, but it was a really special way to end Matt Kint's run. I've never felt this way about a Zero issue before. I guess you can say that. who thought a Zero issue could get me all emotional instead of throwing it in the trash? But
right.
Zero issue. Oh, great. Here you go. Into the paper shredder. But it was really good. We also got to see, like I said, that story by Gage, where you get to see Ninja A, and as I think Tia was really curious about, Ninja B, or Ninjab, as he was affectionately...
And Ninja Ninja. Yeah. Ninja.
Ninjab. Yeah. you actually get to see him, and you see that the first Ninja A was Japanese, unsurprisingly, and had an alliance with Britain during World War I, and he trains a British operative who is Ninja B, and then Ninja B decides that Ninja A might not actually be teaching him everything, because that's how it works, and so he incorporates gadgets into the mix, and so we get to see a little bit of this march through history as these different ninjas show up. So I'm really, really interested for that. I know they've shown some of the concept art for all of the other ninjas so far, and I'm really excited because it's a real diverse mix of people, race, cool. Gender, everything. It's very diversified, and I'm really happy about that. So beyond that, what else? I read Batman 29. Yes, I'm really behind.
Yeah, you are.
I know.
Come on, Nick.
I know. Ugh, I know it's not okay to say this, but this arc is so long. That's War of Jokes and Riddles. That's War of Jokes and Riddles for those who are wondering. I loved the Kite Man issues. I thought those were great. They made me really, really sad, and I think that's why I loved them. But right. This issue was interesting because it's Bruce Wayne bringing Joker and Riddler together to try to solve their differences, or as I wrote, because I think I'm funny, why crack heads mm-hmm. when you can break breads? My issue's summary. That's it. I'm done. That's the end. 2017 was the year I wrapped my contributions to I Read Comic Books. You can all follow me on Twitter. So basically, it's an hour-long dinner with Andre that's in Gotham instead of New York City. And it's interesting because the idea of the nine-course meal, it becomes sort of the skeleton or the structure for the whole issue. As Bruce Wayne, indefinitely not Batman, right, sits these guys down with all of their respective allies on both sides and tries to iron something out. Oddly, a very humorous issue. I think Tom King just liked the idea of the challenge of having all of these, basically the entire rogues gallery in a room and not have a large-scale amount of violence and murder happen. I think that was really the challenge he put himself up to. Right. With this issue. Finally, just one or two brief things to say about Bloodshot Salvation. Bloodshot lives in Michigan now. Just FYI, yeah. For everyone who wanted to know, I guess. He's moved. He's moved to Michigan. I guess I'm not surprised. Jeff Lemire, of course, is a Canadian, so us in the Mitten State are his relatively nearby neighbors, I suppose. And he's trying to settle down and raise a family and his daughter, Jessie. And what's interesting is that all of these issues are sort of a split story. One is taking place now as he's trying to raise his family and realizing that his girlfriend, Magic's family are a real bunch of human garbage and dealing with that. And then 8 years in the future, we're following his daughter, Jessie, who's now like 8 and a half or something like that, and she's on the run from this group called Omen. She has Bloodshot's powers, which is a real interesting fact in its own right, because normally you don't release the nanites from your blood unless you die, and Jesse's mom does say at one point that Ray, that's Bloodshot's name, Ray's gone, so is Bloodshot really dead? Probably not. If so, still could be really interesting. I think having Jessie as a protagonist would be, and having her have to learn how to use Bloodshot's powers as opposed to Bloodshot, who of course was basically, you know, a government experiment, and he got all the user manuals, as I guess you could say. So that could be an interesting story too. So yeah, that's pretty much what I've read. What about you, Mike?
Oh, you know, before I start, I want to say that Nick's house-sitting endeavors mostly just end up with him sending me pictures of this cat that he's watching called Weege. I'm guessing that's his name. Weege, and it's just he sends me Weege, and then there's a picture of a cat. So that's a fun thing. I love when Nick house-sits because I just get all these random animal pictures.
With pictures.
Yeah.
Nick, when does that end, by the way? I hope it's real soon.
Oh no, I live here now. Anyway, so I read a couple books. I had some friends here, so I didn't read a lot. But yesterday, I did try to tackle as many as I could. I read all of Dream Thief numbers 1 through 5 and Dream Thief Escape numbers 1 through 4. Dream Thief 1 through 5 and Dream Thief 1 and 2 are by Jai Nitz and Greg Smallwood. And the last two issues of Dream Thief Escape were by another artist whose name I didn't write down. Because he's not as good as Greg Smallwood, if I'm being completely honest. I thought that Smallwood's art
sounds
was
like
fantastic. I mean, seriously, Smallwood's art was fantastic on this book, and this is one of his first, he said, digital-only books, I think, in an interview that I read, because I was trying to figure out why he jumped off the book, and according to some people on the CBR forums, you know, the most trusted place on the internet, I guess.
Other than
Think it's because... they think it's because he moved on to do Moon Knight with Jeff Lemire, so... It's whatever. I mean, we got more Greg Smallwood, and we got that fantastic run of Moon Knight, so I can't complain too much. But overall, Dream Thief was pretty interesting. I liked the idea up until probably the last few pages of the book. I really wanted it to be self-contained, and I wanted the second one to be like another self-contained story, but instead, the stories bled into each other. And from, I guess from Jai Nitz's perspective, he wants to do more and more of this book. But I'm kind of worried that it's dead. Like, there's not much more to tell. Even though they've inserted some storylines that make it seem like there's more to be said about the story, and this whole Dream Thief thing, which is, you know, this guy goes to sleep and he wakes up and he's committed a murder or gotten revenge for a ghost. That's basically the premise of the book. And I thought containing it in one miniseries was going to be enough, but I guess they want to do more, and maybe there is more to the story, and I'm not giving it a chance, but I feel like the issues that are released were good enough. I guess we'll see. I don't know. But ultimately, I would suggest this book, because I think it's a really cool concept, and I like the way that the story was told. Specifically, I mean, as much as I didn't think that Dream Thief Escape was necessary, I did like the flashback stuff that they did in that series. So go do yourself a favor. Go pick up at least Dream Thief 1 through 5. You'll get some Greg Smallwood art, and it's not superhero-y. It's very realistic, like real-life kind of story stuff, which I think is really good. Like, Greg Smallwood's art is top-notch, no matter what you're reading with him. So go pick that book up. As I said, I read Runaways number 2. I fucking love the Runaways, guys. I didn't read all the tie-in stuff for all the various events, so I feel like I need to go back and like pick through those to get some little details. But I'm loving this book so far. Chris Anka's art is fucking top notch, so good. And see, I also read the Wildstorm, Michael Cray number 1. This is the sister series to the Wildstorm that Warren Ellis is heading up. And Nick is signed because Nick is signed because he doesn't want to read all these.
No. Does this mean you're reading this but you're not reading Wildstorm?
No, I'm reading both.
I didn't think you were reading Wildstorm.
Yeah, it's Warren Ellis. I'm a fucking sucker for him.
I know,
of course,
but
we never
talk about this, Michael.
We've talked about this, and I've been pissed at you because you've been behind me.
I'm up to date now. I'm up to date. I love this book.
All right, Nick and I are doing a minisode all about the fucking Wildstorm, apparently. That's what's happening. So the Wildstorm, Michael Cray, is by Brian Hill with art by Dexter Vines and N. Stephen Harris. The colors by Steve Bucciolato. I'm going to say that. And I'm going to butcher his name, Steve Bucciolato. Get it? One thing that I thought was really interesting about this book, I like the story for this one a lot better than I like the actual Wildstorm series, because it's fucking straightforward. They introduce so many elements in the Wildstorm, it's kind of hard to follow. I did have to do a twice read through to kind of make sure that I picked up on everything. And I think that Michael Cray has the advantage of being about one of the plot lines in the Wildstorm, so it can be very focused on one character, which is beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, really like the idea that they're going with the story. Michael Cray is a fucking cool character to play with, and so I'm really excited to see what Brian Hill with Warren Ellis are going to do on this series. But
he's the
one
who's
thing
got
that I...
the seemingly incurable disease, right? The African American male who's okay.
It's so cool. Like the setup in this issue is so good. I really enjoyed just a handful of things. I don't want to spoil it because it kind of gives away the story. But anyways, the other thing I wanted to mention about this book was that Dexter Vines is doing art on this. And I don't know if that means that he's doing inks or if he's doing pencils, but I fucking love this guy's inking. Like, I love this guy's work, period. And if he's on the book, I know I can trust the art to be fucking top-notch. So I'm very excited about him being on this series. Finally, I did read Grass Kings number 1 because I happened to grab all of the issues that were out during that boom sale that happened, or I think is still going on Comixology. This is Matt Kent and Tyler Jenkins. I don't know if I need to say much more about this book because I know Nick has talked about it a ton, and I'm only reading it because I feel like I want to be able to talk to somebody about this beautiful watercolor thing, and I knew that Nick read it, and sorry, the other way around. I feel like Nick wants someone to talk to, and I'll be that person.
I'm going stir crazy over here.
Yeah. So yeah, that's pretty much me. I bought Persepolis this weekend, so I've got to do that and read that as well. I'm just saying that so that Kate knows that I have it. Okay, so let's move on. Comic books come out on October 18th, 2017. What are you guys excited for this week? Let's start with you, Nick.
For me, it's definitely Sherlock, Frankenstein, and the Legion of Evil, number one. This is technically a spinoff of Black Hammer. It's a miniseries written by Jeff Lemire, just as Black Hammer is, and drawn by David Rubin, who some people might know because he's already technically drawn 2 issues of Black Hammer to date. He drew the one, watch as I forget all the names, he drew the one that was very focused around the space dude who, like, apparates and then, you know, just disappears.
Captain Weird.
He's got the really, you want to talk about great lettering. Whoever does his lettering, it just exudes him, like, as just being weird and out of touch. And he drew that issue, and then I can't remember the other one he drew. So he's already drawn Black Hammer. He also is perhaps best known recently for having drawn all of Aether, which Matt Kent did, which was also for Dark Horse. So that's another
awesome series. Just
yes.
Oh yeah.
And there's a follow up to that coming up at some point. I can't remember when, but for those curious,
I sure hope so.
Yeah. But this sort of follows Lucy Weber, who is the daughter of the titular Black Hammer. And I think this is going to precede Black Hammer in a certain way, because for those who read... Nope, we can't talk about that, I guess.
Yeah, let's just spoil the
whole series. There are reasons for which I believe this will precede the events of Black Hammer, and I've been told to leave it at that. But it should be interesting. We have met this villain before, if you're reading Black Hammer, very, very briefly. And I think this is has a lot of promise, and I really like that Dark Horse is also tending to really get into this whole mini-series runs over ongoings, and I think that's only helping things for them right now. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Tia, what about you? What are you excited for this week?
I am excited for the Bitch Planet triple feature number 5.
Hell yeah.
I've really been enjoying these books.
Me too.
They're just 3 kind of mini stories in a single issue that sort of fill out the world around the main Bitch Planet series and, you know, contribute to the world building and just are, you know, continue the biting commentary on the patriarchy that surrounds us in the real world and barely has to nudge it to a place of ludicrousness to make it, you know, seem
the future is here.
Yeah. It's like very depressing, but also you're just like, yeah, you know, this is the world that we live in, but also mm-hmm. like there's other people who are seeing it for what it is. And we're all going to fucking speak up about it. We're going to do something about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I especially like the last issue. There was, I feel this series, this like series in between the actual series is totally kicking a lot of ass. Like I really am enjoying it. And each issue gets better, is better than the last, I think.
One of the things I love about this and one of the ways that it kind of practices what it preaches in terms of like, we're speaking up and fuck you guys. You know, Kelly Sue, she could do what she wants at this point, right? Like she has a huge platform and she uses it to pass the mic. Like she's she's giving other creators who you maybe never heard of before or up and coming people or whatever, a chance to like get their work out there. And so you get to kind of discover some people. I mean, also, like, I think in this one, there's a mini that, like, Matt Fraction and Elsa Chartier do. So it's like, you know, other people who you already know too. But, like, in the same way that the, like, the essays in the back have kind of been like, and here's this other person who you should definitely listen what they have to say about this. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like that's a benefit of doing this triple feature format.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that up until this issue, and maybe issue two, most of the people I'd never read or seen anything from. So it's cool to just get a sampling of these new creators in a place where I don't have to, like, relearn an entire mythos in order to appreciate their work. Instead, it's like, I understand the Bitch Planet world, and here are people playing in that world, which I really enjoy.
Yes.
I saw the solicit for that in the trade in previews yesterday. Kate was showing mm-hmm. it to me, and I thought it was kind of interesting. I guess you guys would probably have a better opinion, but I noticed that they went ahead and renumbered it as a volume one, which is always kind of interesting when it's like, instead of, like, putting it as, what, number three, they went ahead and kind of took it as its own
different
thing, which is always, I'm always of a mixed mind on that sort of decision, I guess.
It would be misleading to label it as volume three. It's not the main series at all.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, for me this week, I'm super duper excited for my favorite X-Men book. I'm calling it my favorite X-Men book right now.
Oh, God.
Because it's up there. It is the best one. Consistently good work. That's what this book is. Generation X, number 7, by Christina Strain, Eric Koda, and Felipe Ramos Sobrero. Holy shit, guys, this book is good. It's everything that I want about X-Men. I know that I've pretty much called it out every time it's out, so I feel like I don't need to explain it, but it is the misfits of the X-Men doing the best X-Men stuff in the world. It's drama, it's superheroics, it's friendship, it's romance, it's everything that you want in an X-Men book. I don't know how they've avoided it in all the other books. Somehow all of the other X-Men books are fucking up, and Generation X actually gets it. I think Christina Strain, she just gets it. I love her to death. I think I'm a big fan now. Anything else she does, I'm on board, because she has like found a very big place in my heart with this series. And it's only 7 issues in, and I feel like that's strong, but holy cow, this book kicks so much butt. So if you want a good X-Men book, I really recommend jumping into this one. Like, I know I said X-Men Gold. I think that's a good jumping on point if you want, like,
here we go.
Heroics.
I know
if you want action heroics.
It has been 0 days since Mike has declared his love for a new X-Men book.
What gets the number 2 award, Michael? What's in second place?
I think Jean Grey. I think Jean Grey is up there as well. That book is really interesting because it's her hopping around, kind of interacting with other people and other people in the Marvel universe. But Donny Cates in that book, he's really getting into her mind, and they're taking a weird left turn with that book. But ultimately, I think that it's doing a very good job just getting in this young girl's mind and showing how hard it is to not only be, like, a female superhero, but also a teenager, and how, like, she has this legacy that she needs to lead up to, which I know is Marvel's whole thing right now, and how she's dealing with that, and how she keeps saying, you know what, I don't have to follow this path that everyone expects me to. And I really like that about the book. I think he's doing a good job of trying to explain how this Jean Grey is going to forge her own path and be her own person. And he's kicking butt on that. But Generation X is still number 1 because it's a fantastic group book. Christina Strain gets the group dynamic done. She does it so well. So that's all I'll say.
I feel like you could have, like, a weekly show that's like the X-Men book rankings, you know. I guess it would have to be every month.
That would be good.
Like, with the little green up arrows,
books.
You know.
You could do it every week.
Mike Rapp and TRL, basically, but it's just all the... all of the X-Men books.
And every week, it would have to be a video show so he could, like, dress as a different X-Man every week.
Oh, yeah. It would be, like, the poorest man's version of every character, too. It's like, oh, this week I'm Nightcrawler, and I just, like, put some, like, blue nail polish on or something. Our show this week is gearing you up for Halloween. We are going to be talking about horror comics. What makes them scary? What What's the spooky thing that is inside your comic book? How do you define horror? What works in comics? What tropes don't work in comics? We're going to be covering it all somehow within approximately 30 minutes. So, to start, what works in horror comics? What is it about horror comics that just gives you chills? Nick, Tia, whoever wants to start. I've got some thoughts, but I'll leave it to you to start.
Well, I mean, obviously suspense is a big one. I suspect that Nick and I are going to disagree on whether or not gore and bloodshed is effective. Mm. So I'll let Nick I'll let Nick talk about that, and then I'll disagree with him.
Go for it.
Sure. Right. Now that I know that someone's waiting in the wings, at least for me, I feel like a lot of... I feel like it's something that has to be done right, and I think it's so rarely done correctly because blood, gore, entrails, viscera are sort of the very easy paint-by-numbers shorthand for... startling people and scaring people, and the truth is that we are such a desensitized culture, here we go, that I think a lot of that stuff either has to be ramped up to a level that people have never seen before, which maybe that needs to happen, maybe that doesn't, aka Crossed, or...
I recently read all of the Crossed, so we could talk about that.
So Tia knows all about viscera.
Tia, are you okay?
Not, I know, right?
Like, I can't even bring myself to read that.
It was a time.
Tia was very crossed by the end of it. All right. Oh, bye, everyone. That's my second exit from the show.
All I'm going to say is, like, if I ever meet David Lapham, I'm going to run away very fast.
Yeah.
So I think that it's tough to really do that in a way that people haven't seen before. And then, of course, the tricky thing about comics is that you don't have that... certain artists are much more talented at depicting and pacing motion and action in a way that it feels more fluid, but obviously not everybody is, and so sometimes that violence or the action behind the violence can sometimes come across not as just devoid of that oomph that it can have in a film. Like I said, it can be done right, but I feel like for a lot of the books that scare me or set me off in one way or another, it's much more psychological and atmospheric, and we can get into that later. But I'm curious to hear what Tia has to say or what examples she's got, because like for me, it's few and far between these days where that sort of thing startles me. I mean, let's be clear, I'm not a tough guy. Like, if you brought me into an operating room and was like, this is someone's liver or something like that, that alone would be like, I don't care if it's normal operating sterile human anatomy, that alone is enough to fucking set me off. So nobody send me any organs in the mail, please.
Nick's address. Not again.
I mean, we're not a black metal band, so I think we're probably safe. But no, I mean, so I actually feel like, you know, in comics, one of the advantages it has in the horror genre over film is scale. Like, if you want to have like a full gore, guts, bloodshed, viscera everywhere scene in a film, you have to have special effects. You have to have like all the actors doing it. Like, it's really expensive and large scale to make that happen, right? Like, whereas in a, because if
other
you,
than like Evil Dead,
but like, you know, if you're trying to do it in a serious way, it's really easy to veer into B movie territory if you don't have, know, all of the resources. Whereas in comics, like, you just need a good artistic team. Like, I think that colorists are the real make or break when it comes to good horror, like good gory violent horror artwork. But you know, like I said, I recently read all of Crossed, and
Tia's really coming from a place of experience,
like the authority on this now. You know, all you need is like the artist So, okay, so I was talking about Lapham a minute ago. He did cross Psychopath, which was for me the most disturbing run of all the cross was cross Psychopath. And okay.
It's a real badge of honor.
Yeah. Like, there were scenes where the panel borders were made up of, like,
oh no,
the crossed mayhem, like, orgy cannibal fest. And that's just a kind of formal horror form, meaning like the form of the thing, not formal like in a ball gown, that you can't, like, it's just a whole extra layer of a thing that you can infuse with the gore and the violence that, like, you don't have in the film. Like, I don't know, it just, I think, yeah.
It's like more of an atmosphere, yeah, right? Yeah. Like, it's adding to the atmosphere of what the cross is. Yeah. That's terrifying.
And you don't have to get actors on board to, like, do the thing. And you can literally draw any depravity that is in your mind. You don't need a CGI team or, like, a prop team to actually make any of it for you. Sky's the limit in comics.
Yeah.
I was going to say, so is the argument then is still that this type of depiction in comics is scary in a way then? Like, in is it like from a meta perspective where you're like, holy shit, someone had to come up with this? That's truly disturbing.
No, yeah, that one. That one.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, and it is on its face also disturbing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, the imagery is very disturbing. And so I wouldn't call it scary, but it's definitely unsettling and horrifying in the sense that you're like, oh God.
Yeah. Which still, I think, to me, I think that still falls under the umbrella of what horror in general does as a genre, right? It makes you feel unsettled. It makes you feel kind of scared. It makes you feel, you know, get your adrenaline rushing. It maybe, like, has you turning pages really fast because you really need to get to the suspense. You know, all that stuff. I think it still falls under the umbrella of that. So, yeah, that's disturbing and horrific. I think it fits.
Exactly. In terms of suspenseful, though, we were talking a little during the break about, like, titles that are horror titles, but in a more subtle way, mm-hmm. where there isn't, you know, like, cross cannibal raping sort of necrophilia.
That's just in its own fucking genre.
Basically, yeah. The checklist of depravity being utilized. I'm sure Avatar has that. It gets sent to all of their writers. Please include one or two of each of these elements.
Right.
Three beheadings, one lawnmower-based death.
The best remains the Mercury Heat issues where Louisa, the main character in Mercury Heat, like, puts a filter on her brain, like, in her mic, like, because you can put, like, she, instead of seeing all the cross depravity, it gets censored with, like, a rainbow bunny sticker. And so
oh my gosh.
It's so funny. They literally just stick these rainbow bunny stickers over the, like, place where the, like, crossed penis is going into the ear of the corpse skull or whatever. Yeah. Like, it's really
all of you
fun.
Crossed fans know what she's gonna, yeah. We don't need to.
So I think you brought up an interesting point. I think, like, even when you think of truly or books that are meant to be horror, like, say, a Witches or a Harrow mm-hmm. County, like, those mm-hmm. are horror books, but then there are also suspenseful books that maybe aren't marketed as horror books, but they still contain horror elements and can be as scary as some of those true, like, mains or those, like, marketed horror books, right? Is that what you were kind of getting at?
I actually think what separates those is that the artwork is so aesthetically beautiful. And
okay,
you know,
okay.
And so, because if you did crossed style art on those books, I think that you would read them and be like, yep, that's horror. I think that what elevates books like Harrow County and Witches, where, you know, like, genre work gets maligned as not, you know, elevated yep. in a lot of instances, but I think that in the case of the books like Witches and Harrow County, the artwork is just on its own so beautiful and well done mm-hmm. that it gives it a sort of, I don't know, there is another reading that you can make when you look at those books that is that crosses the boundary of straight horror.
Right.
And going back to what I said about color, Tyler Crook does his own, like, he just paints, so he's doing his own color, yes. Right?
Oh, God.
Oh, God. You're so funny, he's, Nick.
Oh, Nick's shivering over there.
But, should we leave you alone with YouTube. The art for they a minute? Have,
yeah, they've got some of the speed runs of his painting the covers of Harrow County. Yeah. Ugh. It's so amazing. Ugh.
But, like, you know, with Jock and Matt Hollingsworth, like, looking at what Matt Hollingsworth does, the two of them together with Jock's kind of, like, more painterly style, and then you add the textures and stuff that Hollingsworth does, like, it just, there's an aesthetic reading you can make of those books that is separate from the horror story and the horror, like, imagery.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And so with non-genre books, like something like Southern Cross comes to mind. I think, Tia, you brought this up in the break. Southern Cross, to me, I did not think was a horror book. Yeah. But I, from what I've heard from those that read most of it or all of it, it turns into something of like a whodunit, but there's also like a supernatural, like, horror element to it. And it's suspense.
It's very Hitchcockian, to me, too. Like,
yeah, it doesn't feel like it'd be a horror book. But yeah, and that's, yeah, I think the Hitchcockian feel, that's a great word, by the way, is something that is missing from some books where it's straight horror versus this suspense, this feeling of dread throughout the whole book.
That's really, it just makes you feel dread. It makes you feel claustrophobic. It's one of those books where you don't see the monster. Like, it's all in your head, and that's kind of what's so scary about it.
Oh, God. I can't do that. I cannot do stories like that. Oh, my God.
You know why those are so scary? Because you can, like, in a book where you see the monster, you're like, their monster's over there. But when it's in your head, it's always with you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a great way to describe it. Okay, I won't even go into that.
Mike's going
to
sleep with the lights on tonight.
I sleep with the lights on every night. You act like this is new.
3 a.m. in the morning. Wait, what if I'm the monster? Kelly, wake up. Kelly, all the lights Kelly, go Kelly I need to tell you something.
I turn Kelly over and Kelly, she's like, I'm a monster. Kelly looks like me. I'm like, oh no, I'm the monster.
Oh my God.
No, there's something that to be said, though, about that claustrophobia thing. I think that reading Aliens Dead Orbit,
oh, God,
you see
yeah.
the monster. But holy shit, that book is a fucking page turner because you don't know when the monster's gonna strike next. Like, and I think that the Alien books do that really, really well. From the handful of Alien and Predator books that I've read, I think that those books are in the sci-fi horror genre, which Nick, I think you mentioned. Books like that exist, and you don't necessarily classically call them horror books, but they totally are. They're totally there to, like, freak you out in some ways. Like, the issue of, what was it? I think it was Alien or Predator. I can't remember. The one that Mike Mignola...
Salvation. Mike Mignola Alien did. Salvation.
Alien Salvation. That book was creepy as hell because you have this constant set of, like, this is just going to be bad for everyone. Like, it's going into the horror movie and going, I know they're all going to die. And that's what every Alien book has been like that I've read.
And I think
and it's terrifying.
Yeah, well, so, like, art-wise, I think there's two ways that artists make you feel that way. One is mm-hmm. when they have, like, a really strong command of shadow. And so you just... Because, like, there's a way of fucking shadow up where it's just, like, a big black blob, and that that's not good.
I wonder what that is. Yeah.
But then there's a way that, like, artists who have a stronger command of using light and shadow, it's not just a black blob. Like, you know something's there, but it's not entirely, like, known to you, and so it gives you this sense of what Mike is talking about that is so horrifying. And the other way of doing that, I think, is more the Stoko way, which is like almost a horror vacui kind of thing where there's just so much going on in the art, like, everywhere, that you just don't know where it's going to come from.
Right.
He also is really, really good at just sort of this constant, like, obfuscation of the alien itself. Like, I think it's at the end of issue one, Mike, you probably remember this, where the guy is running after that all-important suitcase or whatever, and you see, like, of course, because it's alien. Like, rule number one, if you don't want to have the alien kill you, fix your ventilation systems. Fix them. So you don't have steam and smoke just all over the fucking place. Fix that
shit, okay? Are you victim-blaming?
Yeah. Xenomorphs get off on that shit, okay? And there's that panel where he's going to for the suitcase, and you see arising out of the mist, you sort of see just this vague black outline underneath this white mist and the tail creeping out, and you're just like, oh my god, this is perfect. And yeah, I mean, I would say, I think what's interesting about the Alien series is that I don't think all of it is technically, I would classify as horror, but certainly I would say Dead Orbit is, and in the same way that, like, Alien versus Aliens, like, let's be clear, Aliens is still scary as shit, but, like, for me, Alien is still, anyway, that's another, there's a mini-sode right there.
Well, yeah, I mean, I maintain that Aliens are just big cats.
Big, well, they certainly cats. Don't give a shit about anyone, that's for sure.
Weege!
Oh, okay. Watch out, Nick.
Oh, no. He's asleep for now. I'm gonna fix the vents when this episode is done. I'm not taking my chances.
You know, I want to bring up another flavor of horror comics, which is where you expect, like, so I'll say the thing I have in mind right now is My Friend Dahmer, where it's like you almost feel like, and I think Alien has an element of this, you think you know what you're going to expect, and the book itself dances around it. It doesn't ever show it or give it to you. And so your preconceived notion of the characters or the story or what the book is about is what it makes it more suspenseful and tense and horrifying than it is on, if you were just reading it and you didn't already know anything about anything.
Yeah, I agree totally. I think the perpetual strength of a lot of the Alien books is that there is this expectation that you have a crew, something bad happens, everybody gets picked off one by one. If there's a domestic animal on board, that thing will live. If there's a child, that thing will live. And then a solitary human female will live as well. And so, yeah, I agree. There's like a all jokes aside, like Alien movies, just like horror movies on the whole, this is why I think, as you were saying, horror sort of gets diminished as a genre, is that there is this unspoken template or blueprint that exists. And yeah, you can say a lot of other genres, even broad, mass appeal, popular genres, also have this. It's called the hero's journey. Everyone, come on, quit dicking around. But horror, of course, gets taken to task for this, everyone's going to get picked off one by one. And so, as Tia said, it's really fun because there's this whole sense of horror you can induce by fucking with people who come in with that. Or if you want to go another layer deeper, you can fuck with the people like me who know that the blueprint exists and we're already expecting you to break the blueprint, and now you're going to reinforce the blueprint to fuck with me.
Well, what else is great about that?
So play that back, everyone, and you can...
The other thing that's great about that is, like, I think a disadvantage comics have that film doesn't is you can't control the visuals. Like, when someone turns the page, they see the beats in the next two pages. In film, you can control that a little more. But if the most horrifying part of your story is the thing that the reader has in their mind, and you never even show it on the page, you can sidestep that problem.
Yeah, I think to your point about My Friend Dahmer, the whole book is unsettling because you know who this guy is.
But you never see him do anything terrible.
Exactly. You never see, and that's the worst part about it, I think. And I say worst in meaning
waiting.
The best.
Waiting is
like,
the
it's the
part.
Waiting. Yeah, it's just, it's dread. It's constant, like, when is it going to be the bad thing that I know happened? Like, that whole book was like a non, like, I could not stop reading
it
because I was
dog.
Like, get to the part. Oh, yeah.
And you're just like, I know the serial killer, like, I know how that how it escalates. It starts with a dog, but then, like, spoiler alert, he lets the dog go. And so, but bringing your idea of what a serial killer is to this, to that scene, just amplifies the suspense so much.
Totally. Yeah. Everyone should go read that book, because it is fantastic.
And the trailer just dropped, I think. The movie's coming out soon.
This episode not sponsored by my friend Dahmer.
It's just, look, it's really good. It's just,
it is a very good book.
I haven't
book.
Seen the movie, but I've heard good things. But the book is really good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, I hate the critique that it glorifies serial killers, because that is a legit criticism of serial killer culture, which, like, there is this whole obsession that people have with serial killers, that it's like, why are you treating these, like, depraved white men like
rock stars?
Yeah, like, it's you know, and people have been lumping My Friend Dahmer in with this critique, and I think that's a little unfair. If you read the book, it's very critical of of that, and so I just will throw that out there, because it's real. It's about real people.
Yeah, I think the thing that I don't mean to, like, keep going on this My Friend Dahmer thing, but I think the one thing that really, like, totally smashes that critique is that the whole book is about the fact that people didn't realize it.
There were warning signs. No one knew. And people didn't do anything. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's the, like, creepiest part about it. It's that whole anybody could be a serial killer kind of mentality, but it's like, you got to just watch for it. I mean, these things are very obvious, but, like, if you take someone and you just ignore them because you think they're weird, like, it's bizarre. I don't know. I don't know how to properly explain it, but that's the thing. Like, the constant unsettling fear is, like, this guy would continue to go to school. He would continue to do all these things while he was being this depraved individual.
The scariest part of that book is the end, when Backdorf gets the call that one of his former high school classmates was the serial killer, and Dahmer was not his first guess.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Go read this book, everyone. We didn't spoil anything. Seriously. It's such a good read.
You don't even know what happens.
Anyways.
I don't know. Are there any other horror books that we haven't, we haven't talked about, like Sabrina or Afterlife with Archie, which I feel like, you know, the Archie universe has a certain sort of innocence to it. And I think that innocence is part of what makes Afterlife with Archie and Sabrina so extra messed up.
Yeah.
It's almost got that sort of jock prep, you know, loser, that traditional 1980s horror movie, like, high school dichotomy sort of set up already in place. So you've got all of those roles being fulfilled and whatnot. So you can definitely just get to work, because that part of the job has already been done for you.
I think Afterlife with Archie sets itself up the same way that Night of the Living Dead is set up, in that there's just this creeping thing happening, right? Like, these zombies aren't—they're not fast 28 Days Later zombies or World War Z zombies. Like, they're
almost got through the whole episode without bringing up any zombie horror.
I know. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm sorry, but I mean, Afterlife with Archie, it is zombies, a zombie story, but it is. It's not about the zombies, which I find really interesting. It's like The Walking Dead, but not going to fucking last for 10,000 years and be just the same shit every arc.
It might be at the rate these issues come out, but I'm sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but it's ultimately about these people surviving with the constant cloud of darkness that any of them could get turned by, you know, after one mistake. And that's what I think makes that book work really well, on top of all the just terrible fucked up shit that they throw in there for the hell of it. There's some really messed up stuff in there, I will say.
But with Sabrina, I almost want to classify Sabrina in that group I was talking about earlier, where the art is so beautiful that you could almost talk about that separately. I think Robert Hack.
Oh, totally.
Robert Hack. Yeah.
Does the art for that. And, you know, it's painterly. It has these really interesting compositions that just on their face are really worthwhile to dig into.
Yeah. That's like he studied, it seems like he studied old horror posters promos and then made a comic book using that motif.
But you know, that's really smart because those, that is a visual shorthand. Like we have certain strong associations with that aesthetic and with those kind of images. And so, you know, you have to be so economical. You have 20 or 30 pages to tell a story in a comic. And so, you know, using those kind of visual references, or it's just, it's a very smart, economical way to infuse the story with atmosphere, with layers of meaning, and give context when you, you know, you can only cram so much dialogue and action into a panel.
Right. Right. And yeah, the pace at which Sabrina moves is very slow, but it doesn't follow that, it doesn't have that sense of dread all the time so much as it's just like a story about the like light and dark sides of magic. Yeah. And that in itself offers some horror elements, but it also can be nice. Like,
I mean,
it's, I don't know. Also a coming of age story on top of being like a, you know, going to high school and dealing with that on top of
everything. Oh my God.
Else.
Is it so an extended metaphor for her getting her period? Because like,
that's like, probably isn't that is. Every coming of age story?
For
like,
women. Yeah.
For women. Yeah.
I mean, going back to what we were saying about how like, you know, the real horror is within you. I mean, if you have a horror book with too much action and you like, then you never give the reader a chance to settle into that dread. And so you do have to budget in your story beats, those kind of quiet moments or those downbeats so that the reader can really kind of like ruminate over it.
Into a false sense of, Right. I totally agree with that. I think what's great about Sabrina or something like Archie versus Predator, and this is something that I think when we talk about strengths that you only really see in comics, is that we've talked about how horror is sort of niche in a way, for better or for worse, but I think comics obviously are also niche when you talk about mass media and whatnot. And I think what's great is that comics are able to have these really weird, like Archie versus Predator will never be a movie. I mean, God, I hope I eat my words on that,
that because
if, that's a win-win if I'm wrong, okay? But Archie versus Predator will never be a movie, but because you have a lot of these comic book publishers, a lot, not all, that are okay with sharing these characters, you get these crazy scenarios where people that are normal, like, there's never an action of violence in any of their issues, all of a sudden are being hunted down and dismembered by a a space alien attempting to have a, you know, rite of passage on Earth, killing people. No one's gonna make that movie, okay? So I think,
you know,
it's
what?
Really cool that you
bring up a good point. No, I think this is really interesting where you're going with this. Like, there's horror does lend itself really well to just like a tiny little kernel of like a story, like Archie versus Predator, where it's never going to be expanded anywhere else, and it's never going to be expanded into anything but that one shot. I'm also thinking of like creepy comics and like those kinds of anthologies where sometimes like
eerie.
Yeah, like sometimes just the best horror is told in just the tiniest little self-contained kernel, and then you just have to live with this idea forever. It doesn't
Tia, when you, like, we were at New York City Comic Con last year, and Tia picked up this book, The Belfry.
Oh, yeah, Gabriel Hardman.
Gabriel Hardman, yeah. And I went and talked to him at New York City Comic Con this year about how I really appreciated that book. And I'm not, a huge horror fan. I said this before, but, like, picking up that book and just getting the standalone, like, these people crashed, and there's vampires, and blah, 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 like, all this shit. It was so, like, it wasn't even fast-paced so much as it was just a standalone, really well-done, really beautifully illustrated book that just creeped you out. And the ending was unsettling. Like, it wasn't a happy ending.
No, it was unresolved.
It felt so right. And that's how, I think, in my opinion, I think that's what the best horror stories do. They don't resolve their plots into nice little, like, contained bundles. Instead, you're left with the sense of dread and unsettling, like, that this could continue. It shouldn't continue, but it could. And you know that after this story is done, outside of the pages and the, you know, the shared human consciousness in space and, you know, the multiverse, this story lives on somewhere. And that's the creepiest part about it. And the Belfry fucking nails it. Like, Gabriel Hardman, high five to him for kicking ass on that book.
Yeah, it's good.
And I appreciate, like, Tia, I got to thank you for pointing that out to me, because I picked it up digital, then I picked up the physical so that I could, like, meet the guy and be like, I love this so much. And he was super nice about it, too. Like, it was a great, like, five-minute conversation I had with him.
Yeah, he's a cool dude.
And I think he's doing more.
Oh, he is.
I think he said he's doing, not of the Belfry, but more standalone horror.
Oh, good, good, good.
He likes that genre.
No, I agree with you. I think that having an unresolved ending is a big part of what makes horror what it is. And a lot of the anthologies with, like, the smaller little series or one shots, like, they're just, it's a really, really good medium for telling horror stories.
I think the disadvantage in comics with that is that, as we talked about how, like, you know, a big horror movie, if it does well, then they're like, all right, we got to put another $1 million into this thing. We got to do it. With comics, the team is so small that they could easily keep it going. But so I think that there is a respect to be held to say that if a creator does something and it sells really well and it's a really good unresolved plot, if they don't continue it, it's like credit to you to keep me scared. Because otherwise, if you would have kept going, I would have just been like, all right, let's see how the vampires get by this time, you know?
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, like, not to name names, Walking Dead, but Walking Dead.
Yeah.
So, Witches, I think, is going to be interesting in the second series because it's shifting gears to, I think, another, like, family altogether in another place.
Right. So it's like, that's more of like an anthology thing under a theme.
Right.
Totally.
Versus a continuation of the same characters, which can be repetitive in some cases. I don't want to say all cases. I will just say some cases.
Before we move on too far, I wanted to loop back around to what we were saying about Sabrina and being like a coming of age story and stuff like that. And like, I don't know, horror is such a great genre for like critique or analysis of just like culture and people and society
and the human subconscious.
Yeah, no, but a lot of elements of horror were banned under the comics code.
Right.
I think that gave it a sort of subversive feel that I wonder if it would have if it didn't fall under the comics code, what was banned under the comics code for so long. Like, you could critique the human condition in these ways that like Grindhouse, I think, is a good example, you know, where it just sort of it pushes reality to an extreme place.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Sorry, I don't know.
No, that's fine. So I'm like trying to find thoughts on that, but I think you just summed it up very well.
But that makes it a really powerful genre if it was so worrisome that they had to explicitly ban it.
Right, right. It gave it more power, yeah. I think, and more meaning to say, like, oh, if you could get your hands on this horror comic, then that means, you know.
If only you knew, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I guess, Nick, I know that I feel like we've just been constantly cutting you off. Did you have any final thoughts? Because I think we can wrap it up about here. Unless you wanted to go on a big, long tangent, that's fine.
Gosh, I don't know. I would say, I guess, are there any, like, recommendations that people have? Maybe, like, lesser-known books or books that maybe aren't seen as conventionally being horror, but they have horror elements? Because I think that's really what you guys were getting at, is that horror, or good horror, is really a miniseries or a one-shot or an anthology, and that the only real way that you find horror in a long, ongoing book is if horror is merely just a bit player or a, you know, contributing genre rather than the focal point. For Hero County would be a great example of that. There's horror in that, but I mean, that book is so many other things, in terms of coming of age, in terms of like being like a Deep South narrative, just folklore. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, there are a couple books that I would recommend that maybe either people who read the conventional horror and maybe want to branch out, or the people that are leery about the idea of reading horror, but they're more comfortable with other genres, and maybe they want, for lack of better terms, what I call exposure therapy. So, So like for me, Animal Man would be a really, really good example of, you know, something that's like a family drama slash superheroics slash C-list out of the, you know, out of the, you know, the refuse pile of obscurity. Yeah. DC character meets horror. I think that's a great one. Travel Foreman, I could have a whole podcast just talking about his art. I love Travel Foreman. Another one, not unlike My Friend Dahmer for me, that we've talked about before, is the Green River Serial Killer, which is a great book. Jeff Jensen and Jonathan Case, I think, for that. And
oh yeah, that's a fantastic book. It's such a great read. You convinced me to read that book, and I could not put it down. It was very good.
Yeah. So,
Swamp Thing. Swamp Thing. I was gonna say, like I mean, I think the Belfry is a fantastic example. Like, I mean, we mentioned it already. My Friend Dahmer is solid. Those are all the horror books that
Clean
I read,
Room,
so I don't know why
a good
I decided.
One. Clean Room, Gail Simone. If a current one, if you're like, I want something that's like ongoing, Redlands, which we talked about earlier, it's like super horrifying because you've got everything. You got witches, you've got murderers, you've got deranged little chihuahua dogs, you've got demons, you've got racist cops, you've got everything.
That's pretty much everything, I suppose. I think what's really interesting is just a minor side note is how how the big two attempts to tackle more niche genres like horror with like very mixed results, you know, because occasionally they feel like they need to do it. And it's so all over the board. Like, I mean, Mike, I know you weren't the most enthralled with what was that Man Thing?
Oh God,
Man
Thing.
That book was very far from a horror book, though R.L. Stine did write some like little miniature backups. Mm-hmm. But even then, I don't know if you found Goosebumps to be creepy on like maybe that's for you, but I ultimately was kind of like, all right, we're just playing with tropes. Cool. Oh, that's very sexist. Cool. Racist. Oh, a little bit sexist. Yeah. Cool. That's the whole thing.
Over at DC, though, they had Gotham by Midnight, which was Ray Fox and I think Ben Temple Smith.
Oh, yeah.
And that one was really good and really horrifying.
Yeah, first Temple Smith and then Freya. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun book.
It was
book.
Scary. I mean, especially if you're really into, like, religious horror.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the Spectre in that book. If you're a Spectre fan, going on.
Yeah.
Speaking of Ray Fox, if someone can explain Ragman to me, I would really appreciate it.
Is that a thing that's happening in the world? I think that...
I believe so.
Okay.
I think isn't he a super obscure, like, C-list Batman villain? I'm pretty sure...
He's been on DC or the Arrow TV show for a little while.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I gotta hand it to that show. It's not afraid to really dig deep in terms of weird characters.
Hey, Arrow and Flash, they go deep on comics. Like, they're like, this is just a comic book turned into a TV show. We gotta do a little bit of CW drama. Otherwise, it's a comic book show.
Let's just say, though, let's be real. Like, most comics would be improved by adding a little CW drama.
I mean, the X-Men is basically a CW show in comic book form. Like, come on. But anyway,
who doesn't
want to
hear Gavin DeGraw, you know, while Batman's on screen or something like that, you know?
Yeah. God. So I guess we've got a big list. We're trying to write them down in the notes as we were speaking. I think this is really solid. Horror comics are definitely something I didn't ever think that I would be into, and yet I'm very interested in a lot of these, and I have read a lot of these. So, go give yourself... you know, a fun little Halloween treat. I guess that's a thing. We're celebrating this like fucking Christmas this year. So get yourself a Halloween present, read a horror comic book, eat some Reese's spooky eyes. It's just mostly peanut butter with a thin layer of chocolate. And let's wrap this show up. I'm calling it. We're wrapping it right now. Where can we find you guys on the internet? T, let's start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at Portrait of Madam X.
I am Death Star Plans on Twitter.
You can find me on Twitter at Mike Rappin. You can follow the show at IRCB Podcast. You know, like I say every week, we retweet stuff, and I post a poll almost every Friday. This week was who is the most unreliable, and a lot of people were upset that I said Blue Beetle. So,
you should definitely tweet. It was the weirdest poll.
I had to come up with something in the middle of Central Park when I was walking around, and I was like, I don't know.
You didn't consult any of us. I'm just throwing it out.
Which Blue Beetle anyway, Mike? Is this Ted Kord or Jaime Reyes?
It's you decide. Like, that's the poll. No one's voting for him.
Your poll. You decide.
I don't know any of the Blue Beetles. That's the thing. I just needed a DC character.
Okay, the point of all of this is follow IRC Podcast on Twitter so you could tell Mike when he's wrong about the choices that he puts for the polls. It's really fun.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Beyond that, once you're done telling Mike which Blue Beetle you prefer, we're going to make him read some Blue Beetle, trust me, with mixed results. You ought to go check out our Goodreads group. Just go ahead and Google Goodreads IRCB. That's us. We're at the top of that Google search. We've mastered the algorithm. We've cracked the code, kids.
That's great.
We have weekly threads in terms of you can talk about what you're reading, you can talk about what you're interested, if you have comments on popular comic book-derived shows or movies, there are places to discuss that. There are places to talk about our monthly book. For those uninformed, we do currently have two book picks. There's the one that turns into our Book of the Month episode, and then there's the one that you guys vote on. And of course, we have a place to discuss both of those. So there's a place pretty much to talk about everything. Everyone there is very polite, well-behaved. It's just generally a great forum for those who just want to talk about our show and just comics in general.
And we also have, right now for the month of October, Matt Horak, who is the current artist on The Punisher, is doing a Q&A, and he's been answering everybody's questions. He is a super stellar person. We love him, and we're so happy that he's working with us on that.
Check that out. He's fielding everybody's questions, great answers, a lot of information being thrown around. Just really well thought out stuff from that guy. It's really awesome. Beyond that, we also have our website, ircbpodcast.com. Go check it out. There we post our weekly poll list talking about what we're excited for. And also it's another place to check out our episodes if that's how you choose to do it. Obviously we're on pretty much every podcatcher service as well. So that's a thing too. There are choices everywhere.
Please rate the show, subscribe so you never miss an episode, tell your friends to check it out so that you guys can discuss how wrong we are, and then you can tweet us or tell us in the Goodreads group. In all seriousness, reach out. We love talking to listeners. You can email the show at ircb@destroythesaib.org. We love talking to you. We're very needy. Please tell us things.
Yeah. Infinity Shred does all the music for our show. They are the best band in the universe and the nicest guys in the world. So go support them. Listen to all of their music. It's on Bandcamp. It's on wherever you stream music on the internet. Xander is a wizard. He's also the coolest guy. He's just a cool guy, you know? Kind of a cool dude. Also, he edits the show. And I just want to say thank you to everyone. Thank you to all of our Kickstarter backers. This is kicking ass. I cannot believe that we are almost fully funded. If you haven't backed it yet, go to ircbpodcast.com/KS2017 and go back, get yourself a sticker, a t-shirt, just like I said at the beginning of the show. But until next week, thank you all for listening, and we will check you next time.